Right now, it is time for Crime and Punishment, our check-in each week with Casey McNerthy from the King County Prosecutor's Office. And this week, he wanted to highlight a bill that passed through the state Senate. This bill closes a gap in who is allowed to file for a protection order.
So this involves cases where a defendant is found not guilty by reason of insanity. What happens in these cases is normally a no-contact order would go into effect with a conviction, but when somebody has their case dismissed because they're found insane by the courts, that doesn't happen. So it means that the victim has an extra burden to go and get a civil protection order independently of the court case. And that's a big ask for victims, particularly when they've already gone through a whole lot. And so Monica Dingra, who used to work in our office, introduced a bill that would change that loophole, really. And there's some good news out of Olympia on that. Gabby Charlton, who works in our office, who handles these cases, explained to lawmakers why this is important.
If the same case had ended in a conviction rather than NGRI, the victim would not have the onus of obtaining a protection order to keep themselves safe. The court would issue a no-contact order under RCW 1099 that goes to law enforcement. This bill would provide that same protection here. It will ensure that victims in NGRI cases receive the same protections as other crime victims.
What does NGRI mean?
Not guilty by reason of insanity.
I see.
It's a court term that everybody
knows.
And then it's a little tricky still to grasp the difference between the two, but here is David Talley, who's a victim advocate in our office, reading a letter from a woman who was shot in the face. The person who shot her was found not guilty by reason of insanity. This letter from that victim kind of walks through what the process was like for her.
My name is Katie, and I'm a domestic violence survivor. I'm writing you this letter today because I feel my words might be able to help other survivors. Back in 2006, I was living with my ex-boyfriend, Brian. March 27th, 2006 was the day my whole life changed. I saw Brian out of the corner of my eye, so I looked up, and I saw him standing there with a gun pointing at me. I covered my head and said, "No, baby, please don't." Then a loud bang. I realized I was shot in the face because I had covered my head. The bullet passed through my forearm, entered above my left eye, broke my nose, exited my face just 3 centimeters below my right eye, and was stuck in my right bicep. Years went by with Brian committed to Western State Hospital. In 2016, I received a phone call that Brian was given permission to leave Western to visit his family in Seattle. While he was visiting his family, he stole his sister's car and was on the run. Brian tried to contact me on social media and then tried to find me at my job and my home. When I contacted the police, I asked if there was any way to get a protection order without giving out so much personal information. I was told it wasn't possible and it was fair to the person I needed protection from. He needed to know where I was so he could avoid me. I now live in fear of the day that Brian is released from Western State. I worry for the family I now have and the members he knows personally. Having a protection order issued during the criminal proceedings might have stopped Brian from attempting to contact me in the past. It would have provided me a layer of protection should he have found me. This has been an extremely hard letter to write, and I appreciate you taking the time to listen to my story.
Wow, what a nightmare.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, that really, really captures what it's like for victims. But the good news is this, even though it was opposed by some defense attorneys, it was passed by the House and passed by the Senate. And so now it goes to Governor Inslee's desk, and we anticipate that he'll sign it. And then this is really great news for victims if he does.
We're hearing from Casey McNerthy, spokesman for the King County Prosecutor's Office. And there's an update on a state bill to address the illegal market for stolen catalytic converters.
More good news here. So it also passed the Senate. Now it goes back to the House to approve the brief amendments that were made in the Senate. And so it looks like things are really going in the right direction there. And I'm sure the updates here helped. And also the Seattle Times editorial board came out pretty strongly to say, hey, please pass this. We got to get lawmakers to do something. And I'm sure, you know, as predictable as the rain in Seattle, we're going to hear people say, you know, you liberal prosecutors just need to enforce the laws we already have, you know.
Yeah. Well, tell us about you liberal prosecutors and why don't you enforce the laws you already have?
Well, I think that assumes that there are dozens and dozens of provable cases on our desk that we just choose not to file of people who are stealing catalytic converters. But that's not true. I mean, what is frustrating about this situation with, you know, how easy it is to steal these catalytic converters is it's very hard for police to build a case to prove somebody took it, because once you get it off a car and you're down the street, you know, there are cases where cops show up and they see what are obviously stolen catalytic converters, but you can't pin which car it was taken from, and it's so frustrating because you know it was stolen, but you can't prove it in court. So
well, this bill goes after the marketplace, right?
Exactly. So okay. What it does is it provides, you know, penalties in the thousands of dollars for people who are buying these illegally. And that's why scrap metal recyclers support it, because it won't change things for people who are doing it the right way.
So the legitimate scrap metal recyclers are cool with this.
They are. Yeah, which is a great update from the bill we had last year. So that's a really good sign.
Okay, so when does this kick in, and when can people expect to see a change?
Well, by March 7th, we need the House to sign off on the amendments from the Senate. Assuming that happens, it goes to Inslee's desk. And so hopefully, fingers crossed, later on this year.
Okay. We also have an arraignment in the shooting case involving a state trooper.
Yeah. A lot of people have asked, why don't you charge attempted murder? And what most people don't realize is the difference in the ranges for that or assault in the first degree with a firearm enhancement.
So the charge here is assault in the first degree opposed to attempted murder.
Exactly.
Okay.
Yep. And a lot of people have asked, why not charge attempted murder? And what's interesting is when you have a defendant like this, the range for attempted murder is roughly 18 and a half to 24 and a half years if convicted as charged. Assault in the first degree is 20 to 26 and a half years plus the mandatory 5 years for the firearm enhancement. And so I think if you asked 100 people walking down the street which one would have a longer sentencing range, assault in the first degree or attempted murder, mm-hmm. most would say attempted murder, but it's that's not always the case here, and that's surprising for folks.
So you got a pretty good sentence despite the charge sounding like it was a lesser charge.
Well, if convicted, yeah.
If convicted, yeah.
There's a long way to go. The burden's on us to prove it, but yeah.
Don't want to get ahead of ourselves. Remind us of the circumstances here. What happened?
So this was a case in South King County where there was a trooper who was shot, I believe, 9 times, and then the guy took off and was arrested. It was just a really, really tragic case. The state patrol's been having a pretty rough couple of weeks.
Yeah, and one of the charges here was theft of a firearm. How'd this guy get the gun then?
Yeah, it was the trooper's gun.
Oh, I see. So he grabbed the trooper's gun.
Yeah, exactly. So overall, he's charged with 3 counts. And so and that, if those other charges lead to two convictions, too, that'll be another 7 and 6 years at the minimum. And so
I just throw in here, but this is a case where if you had technology that could tell whose fingerprint was touching the gun, right?
Yeah.
The idea of taking a policeman's gun, using it against the policeman, just wouldn't happen anymore.
At least in theory, it would make it. Yeah, absolutely.
Casey McNerthy from the King County Prosecutor's Office. Thank you, Casey.
Thanks a lot, Dave.
This is Seattle's Morning News. Dave Ross with Colleen O'Brien and Chris Sullivan. More bad news about processed foods. Let's page the doctor.
Paging Dr. Cohen.
Dr. Gordon Cohen, MD. So, Dr. Cohen, this is an extensive study which compares health outcomes to the kind of the amount of processed food that people eat. And what did it come up with?
Right, Dave. It is pretty interesting. It was published in the British Medical Journal. And what it looked at was ultra-processed foods. And ultra-processed foods are typically things such as frozen dinners, sugary cereals, potato chips, fast food, and whatnot. And what they stated was that this actually accounts for up to 58% of the total daily energy intake in the United States. So that's quite a lot. Now, this study was unique. What it was a pooled meta-analysis. There's tons of research, as we know, that have been done on ultra-processed foods. And what a meta-analysis is when a researcher goes into the literature, pulls all those studies, and then reworks the data from all the studies and comes up with a new conclusion. That's what a meta-analysis is. What the British Medical Journal researchers did is they took 45, then pulled those together to create even a larger meta-analysis. And when they were done, they had data from nearly 10 million people. So it's an enormous amount of information.
Wow.
And none of them were funded by food companies making ultra-processed food. So all these are important because it means that it's as unbiased and as recent as possible. And what they found was really convincing evidence that higher ultra-processed food intake was actually associated with about a 50% increased risk of cardiovascular disease-related deaths, and a 48 to 53% higher risk of anxiety and common mental disorders, and a 12% greater risk of type 2 diabetes.
Now, how do we know? The study, as I read it, finds an association between these terrible health outcomes and eating this ultra-processed food. But it doesn't show what the mechanism is. Could it just be that people who have healthier lifestyles just automatically avoid processed foods?
Yeah, it's a very insightful comment, Dave. And it's true. It is a observational study in a way, or it's a combination of multiple observational studies. It establishes a relationship that exists. But by the time you get up to 10 million people, that's a pretty strong relationship. Arguably, when they first decided that cigarette smoking was unhealthy, those were the arguments by the tobacco industry against these studies that demonstrated there was a risk of cancer, of lung cancer, or other cancers even, associated with smoking. When saying, well, there's no absolute causal relationship. So sometimes it's hard to prove an exact causal relationship, but you do that by having the most number of people possible, because at some point it's pretty hard to ignore that relationship and not consider it to be causal. And I think that's the case here. And the thing is that they found other things besides, risk of mental illness and heart disease. They also found that there was an increase in people having sleep problems, depression. It's pretty strong evidence and it's pretty convincing. But yes, the argument could be made as a criticism that you can't draw an exact cause and effect relationship unless you define a mechanism. But those things can be pulled in from other studies that have been done.
Well, I have to say, if this doesn't get you to avoid ultra-processed foods, then I guess nothing will. So I guess we need to know what exactly qualifies as an ultra-processed food as opposed to just a processed food.
Right. So ultra-processed foods aren't just merely modified foods. Rather, they contain little, if any, actual whole food. So they're actually made from cheap and chemically altered ingredients that include things like modified starches or sugars or oils and fats. So they're these, basically fake foods when you get down to it. And, we really have no reason to believe that humans can fully adapt to these products because they're man-made. They didn't occur in nature. And so the body doesn't have the metabolic machinery to be able to break this kind of stuff down.
So I assume we're talking about things like potato chips. We're not talking about frozen vegetables. Is that just vegetables that are simply?
No, they're talking about frozen meals. I mean, I don't want to use any brand name,
right?
TV dinner type of things, but Pop-Tarts and Lunchables.
Now, I know that the study proposes the idea that now that we have all this information, should the government step in and basically start treating some of these foods like cigarettes?
There are calls for UN agencies and member states to actually develop a framework on ultra-processed foods. And like you said, very similar to the treaty that was developed on tobacco control. And, in the U.S., there's talk about there being dietary guidelines developed and may make recommendations. I mean, this obviously has tremendous financial implications for, our ability to support healthcare in this country, that if people are eating bad food throughout the course of their life and then they develop these significant illnesses later in life, well, that becomes a burden on society to be able to pay for medical care.
Dr. Gordon Cohen, M.D. Dr. Cohen, thank you.
Thanks, Dave.
Right now, we check in with CBS business analyst Jill Schlesinger. This week, I spoke with Jill about financial interdependence. How long should the older generation continue supporting their adult children? And she took a look at some recent research on that subject.
We've got a new study from Pew Research, and it measures financial interdependence. And I was just floored by some of these numbers. So Pew found that 44% of young adults, that means ages 18 to 34, who have a parent living, say they received financial help from their parents over the past year. Now, of course, these results usually skew with age. So two-thirds who are younger than 25 get help, and that help can come in the form of education, could be helping to pay for college or graduate school. But 30% of people age 30 to 34 are still financially dependent on their parents. That number blew me away.
Like on an ongoing daily basis?
Yes, indeed. And now this can be help in lots of different ways. So, I think the most common way is you have your kids living home. And I have been always amazed because this is a generational shift that's huge. I'm in my 50s And when we were coming out of school, to go back and live with your parents was an admission that you had failed in some way. And we just, nobody did it. I mean, you would rather live with eight of your friends in a tiny cramped apartment.
That's right.
Than go, right? And so that's a real change in terms of, you know, like what's sort of generally accepted in your own generation. So that does not, I don't think that there should be a stigma necessarily, but, you know, I do think that kids are living home longer. This actually became a much different kind of problem during COVID, but a lot of kids are still home. So they're receiving help not just by living home, but they're also receiving help when they move out with household expenses. Maybe they're still on their parents' cell phone bill. Maybe they still are nailing that subscription to Netflix from their parents. Maybe they need some help with their own rent or mortgage. Or, you know, I just think the most amazing thing to me is that the help goes on and on and on. It persists for a long time.
Well, I guess the question is, when, how do you recognize when it's gone too far? Because, I mean, we certainly helped our kids in part out of guilt, because you look at what they had to pay for college and what we paid, and you said, yikes, you know, that's not fair. But when does it go too far?
Well, I mean, I think it definitely goes too far when you believe it is hurting your own financial condition. So, you know, among these parents who said they helped their kids, more than a third said that helping the kids have helped their personal financial situation. That's gone too far. You cannot imperil your own financial foundation and help your kids. So that really requires an open and honest dialogue. Now, I'll tell you the real risk of helping out when the kids are younger is that you may find that you need your kids' help later. In fact, the survey finds that 33% of young adults say they help their parents financially. That's wild to me.
Well, that's the way it was when I know my parents had to help my grandparents because they didn't have Social Security. It was not quite as generous then as it is now.
Yeah. And also that, you know, as people have lived longer, I think they underestimate how long they're going to live and what they're going to spend. And what I hear from people on my podcast every single day is that this financial interdependence is not going away. A lot of younger people are now actually factoring in their aging parents as one of the things they need to consider with their own retirement planning. But all of this requires conversations. And I know people hate doing this, but especially if you're a parent and you really feel like you're struggling, you've got to talk to your kids sooner rather than later. Some of these problems that exist can actually be solved with enough advance warning. If you wait too long and things go really south, then your kid could be in a situation where, you know, when those kids are choosing between supporting their own kids, supporting their parents, something has to give.
We're hearing from CBS business analyst Jill Schlesinger on the issue of financial interdependence between parents and their adult children. And according to Jill, a big thing here is having a planned conversation about the financial future of the family.
For parents, if you want to create more financially independent adult children, you make things time limited, you know, and you actually talk about these things. Mm-hmm. And kids, you know, the thing that's important is that you can say to your parents, I know you've kept me on the cell phone bill. It's been great. I'm going to do that myself. You have a time and a plan to get off these things. You create a game plan that both generations sign on to and feel good about it. And, you know, a lot of these conversations can come about when you're doing estate planning, but a lot of them can come up around tax time. You can just be talking to your parents and say, like, how is your tax situation? Did you owe money? And, like, you'll find a lot of these people are like, yeah, I owed money. And by the way, I don't have the money to pay for that tax bill.
Yeah. Of course, part of it is when the parents themselves haven't saved for their future, right?
Yes, but if you're the child, what are you going to do? You know, I had someone come on the air who said, you know what? My mother made really bad choices. She's a spendthrift. So, you know what I did? I went in, I took over her checkbook. I moved her down towards, you know, where she was living three states away. And she said, you know, look, my mom lost her husband when she was in her 50s. She inherited money. She blew through all the money.
Yeah.
She blew through all the inheritance, all the insurance money. And now and this is not even a young adult, the adult child who's in her 40s said, okay, that's stopping. I'm taking over because if I'm going to help you out, we're going to put a stop to all this spending. And you know what? It's not fun. This is a total role reversal, but in order to make sure that your parents can survive, and in order for parents to feel like their kids can thrive and grow, sometimes that tough love thing, it actually works. Again, says the person who only has dog children.
Right. One more thing. Is there still a safety net? Once upon a time, even if you had no relatives and nothing productive to do with your life, there was a dole that went out to people. I don't think that exists anymore, does it?
Of course it does. That's called welfare. It's called Medicaid. And it's called, you know, you get social assistance. We have a social safety net. It exists. But what most people are, I mean, I don't feel like those are the people who are really at risk. What I'm more, because I feel like the system will protect those people, mm-hmm. but they're not going to protect middle class people who are teetering on the edge.
Yeah.
And those are the ones who are really at risk.
Business analyst Jill Schlesinger. Thank you, Jill.
Great to be with you.
Your Daily Dose of Kindness brought to you by Heritage Homecraft. When he was 12, Sam Cunningham was diagnosed with leukemia. Soon after, Auburn University basketball coach Bruce Pearl recorded an inspirational video for him. Steve Hartman has the rest of this inspiring story.
You can't hear him over the crowd, and that may be a good thing. As Auburn University coach Bruce Pearl sneers and snarls his way through yet another basketball game.
You see him on the court being tough and stuff to all the players, but there's a whole totally different side of Bruce outside of basketball, which is a nice, loving, and caring person.
Auburn freshman Sam Cunningham's unique perspective comes from his greatest struggle. When he was 12, Sam was diagnosed with leukemia, and not long after, someone asked Coach Pearl to record a video for him.
You're going to beat this, son. Cancer? Pick the wrong hombre. Pick the wrong dude to mess with, okay?
It was just real funny to me. Cancer picked the wrong hombre. It picked the wrong dude to mess with. That quote is what I kept with me when I got in my darkest days in the hospital and stuff.
Through all his complications.
You're going to beat this, son.
Through his relapse.
Pick the wrong hombre.
Through the days that felt like they would be his last.
Pick the wrong dude to mess with.
Sam kept watching that video over and over.
Okay?
Eventually, Coach Pearl delivered the same lines in person.
Pick the wrong dude.
And they became friends. Thank you. And then one day, Bruce gave him another, even more inspiring message.
Tell you what. You're going to get better, you're going to come to Auburn, and you're going to be my assistant. And he takes me at my word.
He believed it.
He did. He is.
Today, he is the team manager and so happy to be here. In fact, Sam says Coach Pearl's encouragement may have saved his life.
That truly healed me. I didn't think I would really get to this point from all the complications I had, so that was pretty amazing. I'm just a miracle to be here right now.
This month, college coaches across the country will be praying for a national championship. But here at Auburn, this coach will be asking for something far more consequential.
In my prayers, it's, God, don't let this thing relapse. Take me. Let Sam live.
Basketball seasons come and go. But great coaching lasts forever.
That is Steve Hartman.
And in case you missed it over the weekend, this happened.
This for college basketball history. She does it with a foul shot. Caitlin Clark becomes the all-time leading scorer in major college basketball history. Pistol Pete Maravich, a record that's lasted for 54 years.
Here's G. Scott. And as soon as that happened, I looked at some of the comment sections and people immediately began saying, but when Pete was setting his record, there was no three-point line, there were no shot clocks, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera.
Actually, it's so annoying. I guess what do that.
Have you all ever gotten to that point in your life where you're just like, I'm not arguing with you.
Yeah. Yeah.
Right?
Yes.
And the thing is that when you get to that point, I've finally figured out and understood why what happens. Usually it's because you have either studied that topic or you understand wholeheartedly that topic. And so when you do that, you have better control about that topic.
Mm-hmm.
The Caitlin Clark conversation is something that I'm very passionate about because she's absolutely my favorite player of all time. My son and I absolutely love Caitlin Clark. Let me take you back to what happened. Last season, she lost the NCAA tournament. They lost. They didn't win it. They lost in the championship. She lost to LSU.
I remember that.
Yeah, yeah, right? And so one of the things that my son and I talked about is we talked about, I wonder what she's going to be doing in the offseason. And we talked about, I bet you she's going to be so relentless in the offseason that she's going to come back her senior year and she's going to be gangbusters, right? So that's all we talked about was that. And now here she is, 3,668 points, all-time men's, women's leader. I don't want to talk about anything other than that. She's so good. She's so good that when you turn on the television, all you can do is just, your jaw is going to drop.
She has a magnetic pull towards her, too. When you see, you want to watch her.
She's going to be to the WNBA what Larry Bird and Magic Johnson was to the NBA.
Wow.
Right? It was like, well, when did the NBA catch fire?
Yeah.
When them dudes came in there. And well, so people are listening, so someone might be thinking, oh my goodness, G, what about the other players back in the past? First of all, again, I know Cheryl Millers, I can go Cheryl Swoops, I can go all into women's basketball. But here's the thing that stands out today that's different than yesterday. There's this three letters called NIL, name, image, likeness, right? So years ago, when great players like Caitlin Clark were doing these things, they got paid no money. They got no endorsements, no nothing. So college basketball and or football, whatever the sport is, college sports would make all of this money on this player, and that player would get nothing.
Mm.
Now, Nike is all in, and all of the big endorsers all in. Yesterday at the game, Travis Scott, who, by the way, Dave, Travis Scott is to the youngsters what Elvis Presley used to probably be to you. You
gotcha.
Feel me? Travis Scott was at the game, showed up. Jake from State Farm,
State Farm?
Yes!
Now we're talking
Come
star power.
This is what it takes. Yes! It takes allies bringing attention
you know what I mean?
But
she
game.
Was drawing crowds to those games,
yeah.
right?
Before
Oh, yeah.
Big crowds.
I remember when we were saying, nobody's going to watch women's sports. Well, that's changed.
Oh, it's going to change.
So who's going to scoop her up? I want her on the Storm.
I mean, who's
the top team in WNBA?
Like, right now?
Who could pull a Caitlin Clark?
I mean, the top team wouldn't. It would be kind of the worst team would get them, right, for the draft purposes.
Okay.
You know what I mean? So, look, I bet every city wants to get a Caitlin Clark. I just really love her game. I love how relentless she is. And it goes to show you, I can do a talk on Caitlin Clark, and I just want to say this. For those that have kids or you're an adult, is there anything that you are so passionate about that you will do every single day for 3-4 hours a day?
Mm-hmm.
Whatever that is, you're going to be really good at that. That's what we see with Caitlin Clark when she gets out there on the court. It is just beautiful. Again, I don't get into, what about? I ain't what about nothing.
Mm-hmm.
I want to celebrate that young lady and what she's doing. Des Moines, Iowa, 22 years old, and she's
only 22.
22.
Ooh, she's bad.
She's a bad man.
And she's only 6 feet tall.
That's what I'm saying.
She's 6 feet tall.
Wait. Before
Dang.
I go, Dave,
yes.
How come air topic come up? Why you got to bring up height?
Huh?
What do you think? Impressed by height?
I'm just asking you. Why is height coming
because
up? Everything
got
to be about height.
I spent my life looking up at the world. That's why.
Yeah, that's why he liked Tyler Lockett, because he
right.
finally felt like, he had somebody on his...
guy
yeah.
can catch passes. And,
is that 100... your comb on the floor?
No, bro. It's his comb.
Oh, my gosh, yes. Thanks for listening to Seattle's Morning News. I'm Dave Ross.
And I'm Colleen O'Brien. Thanks for listening to the show's podcast. We're happy you're here.
And you can keep up with the show and find some of the stories from today online at MyNorthWest.com.